of testimony and talk about some of the research that they've done and some of the things that they've witnessed in regards to traffic safety and the seatbelt issue. And but before we get to Ms. Raven and Ms. Smith's testimony, we have the A2 amendment, and if we could get that, I believe that all the members already have the A2 amendment.
Senator Kielesch moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion of the A2 amendment? All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Same sign for opposed. A2 amendment is adopted. Senator
Thank
Murphy.
You. Mr. Chairman and members, if you don't mind, I'd like for Ms. Smith and Ms. Raven to come to the testifying table and give us a few minutes here.
Thank you, Chairman and Committee.
Please state your name for the record. Thank you.
I'm Pat Everidge Smith, and I'm from Meharry Medical College in Nashville, Tennessee. I want to just take a couple of minutes to thank you for allowing us to speak, and I won't stay long. But we are here to support Senator Murphy and Representative Thiessen with primary seatbelt legislation. Meharry Medical College is the oldest historical black medical institution in the country, and we do a lot of work as relates to disparities. Our interest in this matter is the fact that more African Americans and other minorities are killed on our nation's highways than any other group. And we know from statistics and from our research that once primary laws are enacted, that African Americans, more than any other group, buckle up at a higher rate. So we're here to support your efforts and to be of any assistance that we can be. And thank you for this moment to speak with you all.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you again for allowing us to speak with you guys. My name is Othel.
Could you please bring your microphone a little bit closer to you?
My name is Othel Raven. And again, as Ms. Everidge has stated, that we are here to support primary seatbelt legislation. And if you need anything from your friends at Meharry, please feel free to give us a call or email us, and we will be glad to assist you with the primary seatbelt legislation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, for allowing Ms. Smith an opportunity and Ms. Raven to say a few words in front of the committee. They've been leading the charge basically nationwide in a lot of the discussions with seatbelt, primary seatbelt laws, and what they see as a medical college. And a lot of the research that I've read that they have sent to me has been top-notch. And I doubt that, and this is on a national basis, I doubt that the primary seatbelt bill in national scope would have quite the impact today if not for the actions of Ms. Smith and a lot of the folks that she works with at Meharry College. So they... our country owes them a debt of gratitude, especially if you have teenagers. And, Mr. Chairman, with that, I think we're ready to pass the bill.
Thank you, Senator Murphy. Is there anyone who would like to speak in opposition to this bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman just indicated that she was parking her car, so I don't know if you would want to wait for her or...
Well, Mr. Chairman, we should just vote.
Well, Senator Murphy, I believe we have a message from Senator Dahl also. He would like to be here to vote. So do we have any other
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair. Senator Langston.
Well, we've got a little time. I'd like to mention something that was quite personal that happened in my extended family. I have a nephew, Sean Langseth, that is a town cop down in Adrian, Minnesota. He married a woman who had three children. Those three children were in the car with their natural father. The father was in the front seat, passenger side. He had his seatbelt on. The oldest son was driving. He was 17 years old, and he had his seatbelt on. The two other children, between 10 and 13, I think it was, were in the back seat with another friend. The daughter had a girlfriend there who was, I think, between 10 and 13. There was a one-car rollover, and my nephew, who is a town cop, looked at the car afterwards, and he said nobody should have even been injured in it if the seatbelts had been on. The three children in the back had no seatbelts on. All three were killed. We hear a lot about this civil libertarian thing, you know. The state shouldn't tell us what to do. For those two children, brother and sister, they had their funeral service in the school gymnasium. In a town of 1,200 people, there were 1,500 people there. And I kind of wondered how many people of the 1,500 think that you know, people should be able to do whatever they please and so on. And so there are three children that never should have lost their lives at all. And so even before that, I was for being as tough as we could be on seatbelts, and we're really moving. I mean, it's up to, what is it, 84% now or something like that. But that is, I mean, when you stop to think about that, and it's people who died because they were, particularly children, because they were not, did not have the seatbelt on, then you begin to realize this thing about this civil libertarian thing about states should not be telling us what to do becomes very, very minor. So I would hope that this year would be the year it would go into law. I think we're following an awful lot of other states that have already done it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Langseth. Senator Murphy, I guess what I'd like to have you do is give us the number again of the federal funds that we're mm-hmm. passing up if we don't pass this bill this year.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm sure somebody's going to hand me a piece of paper with the exact number on it, but this is just recall here. I knew it was going to show up, see? But recall is that, over, there's $3.4 million in play here. Most of the money under the seatbelt law was predicated upon reaching that 80 percentile. We are already there. So we already have received some federal money for, a compliance rate issue. This last $3.4 million now would be a direct result of us passing a primary law. And if I'm not mistaken, and I'm sure somebody else will pass me a piece of paper if I do make a mistake here, but this is the last year that we have an opportunity to get that money. Now, $3.4 million out of a budget for transportation that is, north of $2 billion doesn't sound like much. But this $3.4 million can be spent on most safety activities that we have currently in the state. And if you talk with anybody at the Safety Council or any of our state troopers that help us here at the Capitol, they will tell you that they have a lot of places where they could use a portion of this money. And if we remember a couple of testifiers that have been in front of our committee in the past, take Mr. Arsenault, for example, that said for, a small portion of this money, we can put cable median barriers up. And Senator Bonoff, your district understands what the price of having good cable median barriers is all about. Those crossover accidents on our highways, especially when they involve heavier trucks, which cable median barriers will stop, are horrendous, and a lot of times people lose their lives. So this $3.4 million, that'll buy us some cable median barriers. It may buy us some more safety programs that are aimed at you know, some of our youngest drivers, which are only 6% of the driving population but represent 12% of all the fatal accidents that we have. So it doesn't sound like a whole lot, but it actually can be spent in such a way that we get a huge bang for the buck. Let's see. Yep, it says $3.4 million on this piece of paper. So.
And when we're talking about raw economics, I think what we also have to consider is a number that's in the insurance bill of each of our insurance policies. I think that number was also going to appear for today.
Another interesting statistic, Mr. Chairman. It's the overall health care costs, and it's estimated that in our state alone, adopting the primary seatbelt will save hospital charges $25 million a year. The one number that I do know, and this comes from some folks in the insurance industry, but they've run the numbers, and in the state of Minnesota, it costs approximately $1.1 million every time someone dies on our roads. Senator Langseth talks about the human element, you know, those three kids in the back seat of that car, you know, and that's just a tragic loss to any family. And then for the rest of us who may not see those losses in our family, we see the direct economic occurrence through higher insurance costs, higher medical costs, you name it. When someone dies on the road, you would be very surprised at all the activity that goes on to, you know, kind of clean up the loss of life. But, you know, it comes right back to it. I think 30 lives are a year in the state of Minnesota. If we could save 30 lives a year in the state of Minnesota, that's worth all the tea in China, if you ask me. Senator Langseth came and gave me a little pep talk one time here about 16 years ago, and I can kind of remember it starting off as you got a lot to learn. And I'm glad that Senator Langseth, you know, one, for you sharing you know, your family's story behind this, and also kind of taking a kid that was wet behind the ears and giving him a towel to dry off with. So thank you.
Okay. We have a couple of committee members that would like to speak. Senator Saltzman.
Well, just to thank you, Senator Murphy, because I think that we vote on a lot of bills, but to have a bill that really impacts people. And very briefly, my son was following his boss this last summer, and a car crossed the center line. And my son went into the ditch. His boss's car was on fire, and he pulled him out of it. And he survived, but he is still in a rehabilitation. And I think for young people, they don't understand until they actually see something firsthand, the impact of what cars can do. So I want to thank you for continuing to pursue this, and that may the Senate position prevail in the end.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Saltzman. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Murphy brought up the importance of the cable median barriers to my district. And so just as background, if people were wondering why Senator Murphy said that, there's a stretch on 494 where the cable median barriers had been put all along from, I believe it was 169 and 494, and it was to go all the way down to Highway 55, and there was a stretch that wasn't finished. And on that stretch, in one season, there were several fatalities. And so I carried legislation to put those cable median barriers up. In fact, MnDOT had planned to, and we now have them. And so I'm appreciative of that. But we did see firsthand that those lives would have been saved had they not been there. The other thing I wanted to mention is I send out a newsletter at the end of every week, and so last week when I sent out my first newsletter, I talked about this initiative. And I said, you know, regardless of what people think, this is something I'm going to be championing because it's important and it does save lives. And so I got a lot of responses. Some were favorable, some weren't. But this is just to publicly say, Senator Murphy, this is one case where regardless of the constituent mail, I'm going to support your bill because it's the right thing to do and it will save lives. And for, you know, I'm a mother of four drivers, so anyone who's sitting around this table who has those teenage and young adult drivers, it's pretty scary.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I haven't talked a lot on this issue just because I've been, you know, very supportive, and the Senate has been pretty supportive, and I suspect it will be again this year. But I did want to make just a couple of statements and observations. I noticed in the paper just today, I don't know if other folks saw in the Star Tribune, it was just an inch or two column, but it was about a teenager who died over the weekend, and a determination was made that he died because he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. It's just, you know, it's a shame, young life like that lost. You know, some might argue that we're doing pretty well in seatbelt compliance, but and so why do we need to do any more? We're doing okay, but you know, we do have what's called a Towards Zero Deaths initiative in this state, mm-hmm. and we've been making good progress, and we're seeing declining fatalities. There was a great article in the paper a few days ago about that. But you know, I believe in that goal, moving as close as we can over time towards zero deaths. And the fact of the matter is that you know, there's run into that population now that's hard to persuade. And I think Chairman Murphy has articulated they're hard to persuade in part because we don't have the foundation of law that says, you know, you have to wear your seatbelt, and if you don't, you can be pulled over for that reason. It's just if you happen to be pulled over for some other reason, then, and we notice your seatbelt's not hooked up, then you get in trouble. And I think it's a, you know, we all the folks who are already doing it, that's great, but let's persuade those who maybe haven't thought about it or haven't been motivated enough to think about it. We're also struggling, of course, with significant increasing costs in our healthcare budgets, and there's a lot of talk about that all over the place. And we talk a lot about people who die, but we don't talk a lot about necessarily about people who are permanently disabled and the expense that's associated with that, and the tragedy, and of course, the difficult circumstances those people and their families find themselves in. But the truth of the matter is, if we're just talking about self-interest and larger public policy imperatives, the fact that a lot of people survive these crashes with much more severe injuries than they would have otherwise, and are permanently disabled and have ongoing, very, very expensive medical costs, we pay for that. On an ongoing basis, directly in the form of our tax dollars and driving up health care costs, as well as driving up costs in a lot of other areas. And I also have a personal experience. My sister was in a rollover, and happily, unlike what happened in Senator Langseth's family, everyone in that car was wearing a seatbelt. And we were quite alarmed, and we went to the hospital. We were all very shaken up and very worried, but she walked out of that hospital just a couple of hours later with some bruises. She would not have survived that rollover otherwise. They were driving too fast. They were being irresponsible. They were young, crazy, whatever, going down the road and just flipped over into the ditch, and they all emerged unscathed from that accident because they were wearing their seatbelts. I want more families to have that story and not Senator Langseth's story.
Yeah. Senator Steben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Dibble, for sharing those thoughts. It's very clear that the Senate has been supportive of this legislation in the past, and Chair Murphy, I was just curious what your strategy is this year to see that this finally becomes enacted. I'm sure most of us in the room remember the governor's theatrics last year over some of this legislation and the conference committee. And are you thinking you're going to send it on its own this year, or what? Mm-hmm. What's the tactic to actually get it passed? Because to tell you the truth, it's kind of frustrating that we're still that every year now it's becoming a perennial bill we have to hear again and again.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Steben, You know, most of the time when you're carrying bills around here, you kind of keep your cards close to your vest. But in this instance here, you know, we've tried that in the past, and we haven't been very successful. This is where we're at in the Senate. This bill has to go through Senator Moy's committee next, and then to the Senate floor. And I would imagine that, you know, if it makes it through committees, we'll have a positive vote on the Senate floor. I, you know, historically, the Senate has been passing this every year. In the House, Representative Thiessen is in charge of the bill. It has to go through three committees over there. It's going to be a hard road to hoe over there. But they're committed to get it through all the committees and get it to the House floor. You know, last year we didn't want to have a vote on the House floor because we thought that it would probably come out against us, as it inevitably turned out to be. There's different players over there this year. I think the vote total is close, but I would rather run these as separate bills instead of putting them in an omnibus bill. But at the end of the day, if we have to put it in an omnibus bill to get it passed and put into law, it's going to happen this year. Otherwise, I can guarantee you one thing. The House is not going to be happy. That's not a threat to the House. That's a promise. They will not be happy unless primary seatbelt becomes law this year.
Senator Murphy, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the Kathy Swanson bill, Senate File 42, be recommended to pass and
as amended and re-referred
to Judiciary Committee.
Senator Murphy moves Senate File 42 as amended. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Bill is passed and sent on to Judiciary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members.
Next on the agenda is Senate File 33, Senator Olsen, Type 3 school bus legislation.
Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, could I indulge for a second? Last year we passed the Office of Pupil Transportation Safety, and that office has happened, and there's been a lieutenant appointed to that office, and it's Lieutenant Ed Carroll with the State Patrol, and he's here today. This is him standing behind me, and he was in my office, and I'm looking at him, and I thought, this guy looks familiar. We went to elementary school together in White Bear Lake, so last time I saw him, he was looking for a clutch alignment tool. So I'm pleased to say that we're moving forward on the Office of Pupil Transportation Safety, and he's going to also have three more troopers assigned to that office, I believe, in July or August. So, members, I'm here today on Senate File 33, which has to do with last year, you'll remember we had the Type 3 vehicle bill, and that bill, I thought it was a very good bill, and it moved forward with Type 3 vehicles are school district vehicles like vans or they can be a car, a suburban-type vehicle, or anything that carries 10 passengers, including the driver, and less. And the problem that we ran into, I believed, was that we were trying to balance, you know, having drug testing and physicals with, you know, school districts with their coaches in these smaller activities where they will use the coach may drive the golf team to an event or the speech team or cross country, any one of those kinds of events, smaller participation events. And it was going to be a tough position. I mean, these people work in the schools every day, and to have them subject to the drug test and the physical on a biannual basis was going to be a cost problem for these smaller sports. And I was afraid that a lot of primary rural school districts would drop these sports if their coaches and advisors had to had to have the physical and the drug screening. So in the language last year, we said people whose normal duties do not include transporting. And so that word normal kind of was what threw a monkey wrench into this thing. And DPS's attorneys have interpreted that by meaning normal, if you're the speech coach and you normally drive the students to the speech event, that's part of your normal duties. So we've heard a lot from school districts, and so we worked to correct the bill. Mainly, this is a technical correction on language. Our intent is the same, that school advisors and coaches of these small sports do not have to have the drug testing, which are actually a pre-employment drug test, and the physical. So in light of that, there were some other technical changes to the bill. We had said that you had to have a Type D license, and we changed that to say that A, B, C, or D, so that any driver's license can drive a Type 3 vehicle. I carry a Class A license, so basically what we had before is, although I carry a Class A license, I can operate any combination of vehicles. However, it wasn't really clear if I could operate a Type 3 vehicle. So we changed that in the law so that that's more inclusive. And then we added more training, and there was a lot of heartburn with school districts on the pre-trip inspection of the vehicle. And so we worked with the State Patrol, and we came up with a very simplified pre-trip inspection that is very similar to what a lot of government units will use. It's basically a visual inspection of the van or the vehicle that they're driving. You know, check, make sure the tires aren't flat and there's windshield washer fluid in the tank, and just those kinds of simple changes that can be a quick walk around the vehicle, and before they drive off with the students, they recognize that the vehicle's in good operating shape. So I appreciate working with the State Patrol to simplify that. It was a very complicated form originally, and so this is a much more user-friendly version, and it'll still accomplish, you know, that the vehicle looks safe. And also we can have a designee do that. So if the school district has a mechanic, the mechanic can do that pre-trip and sign off on it too. So there's an option with that. And we get kind of the crux of the change is that we've struck in language that talked about the normal duties, and we put in language that an employee of a school or a school district who is not employed for the sole purpose of operating a Type 3 vehicle is exempt from paragraphs E and F. And that's the pre-employment drug testing and the physical. But we did add something to tighten that up, is that now they're subject to an annual driver's license inspection. And we had exempted them from the bill last year for that, but we put that back in. So if that same speech coach is driving, they will be subject to an annual driver's license inspection by the school district. So I think that that will go a long ways towards alleviating concerns that the legislative auditor had a number of recommendations prior to this, and I think this kind of puts it back into a form that there will be oversight over who's driving these vehicles. There's an unintended consequence to the law that we passed last year, and that's they're going to testify in just a second here, and that has to do with the schools for the deaf. Because when we put in the requirement for a physical, like in Faribault at the school for the deaf, a lot of the paras who work with the kids transport those kids also. And so when we put the requirement that they had to have a physical, you know, you cannot pass the school bus physical without, you know, you won't do too well on the hearing portion if you're deaf. So I reckon that wasn't even on our radar screen, so that was a mistake that came up afterwards. As I say, you'll hear testimony on that. And with this language we have now about being hired solely to operate a Type 3, being subject to the physical, that will alleviate that problem. So that's pretty much what we've done to the bill. I believe the corrections, like I said, are mainly technical. I think we've still got the intent. I think we all need to remember that when Amanda Berglund was killed up by Forest Lake, that you could operate a Type 3 vehicle with the legal limit of alcohol in your system. There was virtually no regulation on these vehicles. And we've gone a long way to tighten that up. However, I think these corrections we made are going to be a good thing, and with school districts, particularly small school districts, with these smaller activities. So with that, I think we have next to testify, if I can find my sheet. will be Linda Mitchell.
Ms. Mitchell, please identify yourself for the record and continue with your testimony.
I am Linda Mitchell, the superintendent of the Minnesota State Academies, located in Faribault, Minnesota. The Academies is one state agency made up of two special and unique schools, the Minnesota State Academy for the Blind and the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf. We've been serving deaf, hard of hearing, and blind, visually impaired children for over 140 years, and we're here today to talk a little bit about how this new law impacted our programs. We are residential schools, and as educators who work at these schools, we understand the great responsibility bus drivers have in transporting other people's children. Our students live at the schools, and they're transported home every Friday afternoon and come back to us every Sunday. So we're not here to dispute the requirements for school bus drivers, and we know the precious cargo they carry and understand the need for regulation of bus drivers' licenses. But we also know that there were some unintended consequences of this new law, and we want to share with you how that's impacted our programs and activities as well as our budget and our staff. When the new law went into effect, we immediately contacted our employees and sent as many staff who were interested to get their physicals. And as Senator Olsen explained, obviously we didn't send our deaf staff because they wouldn't pass the physicals. 65% of our staff who work in the dorm and the school program are deaf. So this really impacted the flexibility for our programs. We sent the people we could to the training and got as many people able to drive as we could. We have figured that if this law were to stay in effect, it would add an additional almost $10,000 to our budget if we were to do this, not just for the physicals and the other variables for training, but also for the few folks that we have who can drive who are hearing who we have to pay overtime right now. Our staff drive our students to a variety of places for a variety of reasons. They live at the school, so there's not only the school day activities where we have job sites and job coaches who take students to their sites. We drive students to doctor, dental, counselor appointments. We take kids out for pizza. We take them to Walmart for toothpaste, as well as after-school activities, athletic events, and pizza parties, et cetera, et cetera. We don't need a school bus for these kinds of activities. We are driving students in sedans and minivans. So these are folks who in the past have driven with a regular driver's license. On our MSAD campus right now, we have 8 job coaches, 6 of whom are deaf. I now have a supervisor who is doing almost all of the transporting, driving teenagers to the job sites, and their job coaches are driving separately because they can't carry the students with them. Ironically, we teach driver's ed to our teenagers on campus, and so we now have 16 and 17-year-olds with their own driver's licenses who could drive their job coach to the site if the job coach wanted to ride with them, but the job coach couldn't drive the student to the site, and I don't think that was what was intended. So there's something wrong with the picture here. We know it was not intended to be discriminatory, but I have to say for our deaf staff, that's how it feels. And we have many deaf staff on our campus because they are good role models for our students. It's been difficult for them to explain why they suddenly can't drive a student across town to go to Walmart for toothpaste. But having said that, we would urge you to consider this amendment. And then we can get back to the full operation of our programs and activities. With that, I would turn it over to Sean Vernon, unless someone has questions for me.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, now we have Sean Vernon from the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sean Vernon. I am a licensed educational administrator and interim student life director at the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf. Established in 1863, the MSAD is a dual-accredited statewide public school that provide standard-based education and related services to students 0 through 21 years of age who are deaf or hard of hearing. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 33, and I would like to focus on several key points about the proposed exemption that will allow qualified staff who are deaf and hard of hearing to drive the students again. The mission of MSAD is to promote the highest level of self-sufficiency possible for deaf and hard of hearing students. Getting a driver's license, too, is a rite of passage for our students towards self-sufficiency. However, without the exemption, our driver education instructor, who is deaf, is unable to fulfill his responsibilities as a qualified instructor. This then prevents students who are deaf or hard of hearing from having the same opportunities as their hearing peers. The educational process at MSAD is provided in an environment where direct communication access is available to all students at all times. Recently, my staff, who is deaf, had to drive himself while his hearing colleagues drove our students to a traditional off-campus holiday gathering. Suffice to say, this was demoralizing and awkward for this loyal state employee, who is deaf, and the hearing colleagues and even the students, especially for a holiday gathering. Now, federal law mandates that services provided by MSAD meet the students' need for a free and appropriate public education within the least restrictive environment. Our work-study program has been struggling to comply with this mandate so that our students can hold their jobs in the community. There are many other instances where the free and appropriate public education for our students were potentially compromised due to unintended, unforeseen logistical challenges. Now, this is not all about our staff members who are deaf and hard of hearing, but also it impacts our hearing staff. They, too, have been burdened with additional duties, responsibilities, and accountabilities. To illustrate, I would like to read a statement shared with me by a hearing staff person at MSAD. For our staff who are hearing, this law has been a huge time consumer. I've had to go get a DOT physical, and I'm still waiting for reimbursement. This involved 2 trips to the clinic. I have to drive a student almost every day to and from her gymnastics class in the community. In addition to this, I'm often asked to transport students to various events and establishments in Faribault. This greatly consumes my time. I find that I barely have time to catch my breath or to complete my own daily work tasks. It's very tiring to do this on a daily basis. I have also transported students to and from sporting events. In the past, the MSAD athletic director, who is deaf, and coaches who are also deaf could transport students. Often, I'm the only one in my area who deals with specific phone calls, and then there are parents or others who become frustrated when I'm not receiving their phone calls or attending to student needs and issues. I find this to be extremely taxing. On top of all this, I have to check the engine, tires, lights, and so on to fill out a form stating that the vehicle is fit for transporting students. So please support Senate File 33. Before last year's bill was passed, qualified academy staff who are deaf and hard of hearing transported students safely to educational and co-curricular activities and field trips. Please revise the law and let our staff who are deaf and hard of hearing do the jobs for which they are already qualified. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Veering. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, if there's no questions, then we have Allison Porter, who's a student at the Minnesota North Star Academy.
Just a moment, please. The interpreter needs to get papers.
Hi there, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me testify today. I would like to thank Senator Olsen for introducing Senate File 33.
Excuse me, can you please be sure to state your name for the record?
Yes, sure. My name is Allison Porter, and I'm from the Minnesota North Star Academy. This is my third year at Minnesota North Star Academy, and I would like to talk about the Type 3 mandate that has impacted me and other North Star students. We have about 35 high school students total at our school. And we used to have a cooking and transition class that required transportation that would allow all of us to go to the grocery store or go to various places that we had to go to because of this class. But now, because of this new law, our teacher, who is deaf, is not able to transport us. The teacher is also not allowed to drive us to games or any other type of activities where we would compete against other deaf teams. Now we have to pay to rent a bus to take us anywhere, to go on a field trip or to go to various class activities, events, because of this law, because our teachers are deaf. And this law is saying that they can no longer transport us anymore. So here we are stuck with that. Also, my school does not have a full court gym. It's only a half gym. Previously, we were able to go to the YMCA for our activities whenever we wanted to play or practice for our games. And now, because of our coach who is deaf, we can no longer be transported there, so we're stuck with practicing and having games in this small gym at North Star Academy. It's been very hard for me and the other students at North Star, as well as for our parents. It's very expensive for my school to pay to rent this van for all of our activities. Also, the teachers... Also, the teachers at the deaf school, it's actually safer to have deaf staff transport us because they can sign and they can communicate with us. The other bus drivers don't know sign language and they're not able to communicate. So if there's an emergency that were to come up or any type of situation where they would need to manage the children for being disruptive on the bus, they would be able to communicate with us because they know sign language. So I'm hopeful that you will consider changing the Type 3 requirements for our coaches and teachers to be able to drive us and take us to our field trips and activities and be able to go to the YMCA again. Thank you for your time to hear my testimony.
Mr. Chair, I need to apologize to the deaf community because this flew under the radar. This was, you know, I guess I was not even aware of this issue, but her testimony was very... I think right on the ball there where she mentioned that when a deaf teacher or coach is driving the students, they can communicate with them through sign language. So I think that's a very good testimony, and I appreciate that. But so moving on, we have...
Senator Olsen, I'd like to ask Ms. Porter a question. I'd like to ask Ms. Porter...
Sure.
If you have a non-hearing bus driver, do you feel any less safe?
If the driver can't hear?
Correct.
Well, we'd like to have a deaf person that is deaf driving because they can communicate with us. So if a kid is acting up or being silly, somebody can interact, somebody with authority. It's hard for us to communicate with a bus driver that doesn't know sign language because they don't know what's going on.
Thank you. Very good answer. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, now we have the School Board Association and Captain Urquhart from the State Patrol.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Kirk Schneider, and I'm representing the Minnesota School Boards Association and all 340 school districts that belong to our association. The circumstances surrounding this legislation have been unique. We understand that. And I think at the end of the session, the fallout from this legislation was unique itself as well. And probably this is one of the most time that I've spent on an innocuous bill as this than any other bill in my time here. And so I applaud Senator Olsen and members of this committee and the Department of Public Safety who have gotten together and recognized the challenges that this has created for a number of school districts and their employees, and tried to correct those things to make it work for local school districts. And I think that's one of the challenges you see when we create a one-size-fits-all for all our school districts. The unique circumstances that arise, such has been shared here today, create some unique challenges. So, as I said, Senator Olsen has been great to work with, and I think that one of those issues that we needed to have clarified, and he worked with this on clarifying, is the issue of all employees being trained. Now, I think that there's still that requirement as part of this that all employees or those folks who will be driving the Type 3s will be trained. And that was one of the situations, one of the circumstances that school districts experienced, is they were unsure whether all their employees needed to be trained or the uncertainty about whether it was just the Type 3, those folks who would be driving the Type 3. And so through our experience, the superintendents and boards have got a little bit wiser about this, and they've drilled down and to focus on those individuals who will likely be driving those Type 3 buses and provide the training for those. And the Department of Public Safety has been willing to share that training component with our school districts. The mandatory drug testing is a piece that we're exempt from as well. There was a lack of clarity about whether this was required for those folks who were driving on a part-time basis or driving two or three times, the debate coach or the golf coach. And the cost of the physical examination was probably the biggest issue and the sorest issue for our school districts. While we're going out telling them that they're exempt from this piece, we had other stories being shared that they weren't exempt from this piece. So this clarifies from $100 to $180 for school districts per employee that had to go through these pieces. And so now that it clarifies this piece, and I thank Senator Olsen for understanding that. And school districts have gotten creative with this as well. To avoid that paying that cost, what they've done is they've used the big school buses, the big yellow school buses, or they've started to use public transportation rather than having their employees go through that $180 cost for the physical examination. And the record-keeping piece also is still intact in there, but it's clarified in there as well. So as I said, the districts have been creative. We understand that the fixes have been here, and Senator Olsen has been very receptive to those. And so we're content, despite the requirement for the additional training, we think that may provide additional safety measures for school district employees. But he's made it very clear that it's only those employees who we hire to drive the Type 3 bus that this piece fixes. So I will stand for any questions that you may have.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Schneiderwind.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, now
Senator
we have
Olsen.
Captain Rickert from the State Patrol.
Thank you.
Captain Rickert.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Ken Rickert. Prior to the appointment of Lieutenant Carroll, I served as the Pupil Transportation Safety Director for the Department of Public Safety.
And Captain really, Rickert, could you bring your microphone a little bit closer,
sure.
Please?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Really, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm here to answer any questions on behalf of the department you may have about the existing law or this legislation.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you. A little too close. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Captain, first, just for everybody around here, the captain didn't have that little shock of gray hair in the front of his head last year before we did what we did. So, Captain, thanks for you and all the members of the State Patrol for hanging in there and bringing this forward, making sure that it's correct. Captain, it's your understanding that this does the trick. Is that correct?
Captain Rickert.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, I think that once the existing law passed last session, we were inundated with phone calls from the industry and just like some of the other folks that testified here today. Mm-hmm. And from our perspective, the two significant challenges in the existing law were those physical examinations, right, and the drug and alcohol testing situation. Mm-hmm. And I think that this legislation deals with that.
Okay, so
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Captain. So everyone in the industry is on the same page, is what I'm taking from your comments. I'm sure that Senator Olsen feels the same way. This was clearly not the intention of the legislature to put so many different groups at odds with law or common sense. And I'm glad that, that there's been a resolve to this situation. The Captain and the School Board Association, Principals Association, a lot of different user groups from, bus drivers right on down the line, worked pretty hard all summer long and through the fall to make sure that we kind of came to this point here. And Senator Olsen, thanks. I'm glad I won't have to field any more of these calls.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, will be glad. It is true what Senator Murphy mentioned, the Minnesota Association of Secondary Principals, Elementary Principals, State High School League, the school administrators, business directors, the intermediate schools are all in favor of these changes. So it's one of those deals where, everybody's a little bit unhappy, but I think in the end we've end up with pretty good fix to the bill. And then I believe there's one last testifier, and Mr. Whitney Wise from SEIU.
Thanks. Mr. Whitney Wise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Josh Whitney Wise. I'm here with SEIU Local 284. And when I had originally scheduled the testimony, I had asked if it would be all right if Carol Neeters, who's the executive director, could give the testimony, schedule permitting, and she's actually here now, so I would ask that she be allowed to testify.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me this time to address the proposed changes in the Type 3 bus bill.
Please state your name for the record also.
Carol Neeters, Executive Director of Local 284.
Thank you.
I must let you know that we are opposing this bill, and it's because we do not believe the intent of this bill does not match the scope of what the bill will actually do. Two primary concerns. One is in the last line of the bill that exempts some from physicals, and more importantly, the drug and alcohol testing as a primary concern. And two, allowing any person or a person with any class of license to drive a Type 3 bus. Senator Olsen had shared a story with me last week about how this bill originated around the accident of a student in a Type 3 bus with a driver under the influence of marijuana, and both driver and student were killed. And my concern is, by exempting or taking that out, how does that address the issue and not put that before this committee again at a later date when another crash happens? And so I want you to think about, our student safety should be entrusted to qualified employees. While Type 3 buses differ from larger school buses, they still require the same skills that bus drivers are trained in. We should not be putting this burden on others. And I know the intent of this, and it's been discussed by several folks, is to allow teachers and coaches to drive. However, nowhere in this bill does it state that specifically. And while that might be intended and assumed, that may not be what very well happens within districts or in private companies that service school districts and provide transportation. And secondly, eliminating the physical requirements and drug testing prior to allowing a non-driver to transport students puts the students at risk. Drug testing is a district-by-district policy and not mandated before hiring for teachers or other support staff in school districts. And by private companies, it's left up to them if drug testing happens on initial hire. This is too likely to have this issue or folks slip between the cracks. Bus drivers are drug tested at random school bus drivers and are required to pass exams every 2 years to renew their bus endorsement. This creates a huge double standard for drivers. Is it okay to put 9 students at risk with this, but not 10. This we see as a distraction to the larger problem of inadequate school funding. We feel that the legislature should be concentrating on how to adequately fund education so that our students can be served by the most qualified employees instead of figuring out how to cut corners and shortchange our kids. Public safety and protecting our most vulnerable should be a top priority, and I ask you to think about how this reduction in standards achieves that. Public school transportation is too important to leave to chance. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, was SEIU part of the discussions over the summer and fall?
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, we contacted their office twice, and I think because of some changes within their office and personnel changes, we never did hear back, so we did not have, they were not at the discussions that we did hold. So,
Okay.
Actually, can I clarify that?
At the initial meeting back in August, SEIU did have a representative there. And then about 6 weeks following that, September, there was another meeting scheduled which ended up being canceled. And then after that, kind of fell through the cracks. So,
okay. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Their concerns are probably legitimate concerns, but I'd like to address them because one of the things that I mentioned, by allowing school districts now, well, we're requiring them to do an annual license background check on their driver's license. And also new hires, because of Senator Rest's bill, volunteer coaches and those kind of folks are subject to a BCA test. So although school districts do vary on whether or not they require a drug and alcohol or a drug test pre-employment, they do have to do the BCAs, I believe. So the driver's license, if there's a speeding history or a DWI, that will show up in their licenses. So I think we've actually added more controls over the bill because the drug test was actually a pre-employment, so it was a one-time event. So this ongoing annual driver's license record inspection, I think, really does strengthen the bill. So I guess that's my main counter to their concern on that. And then if we can remember back to last year, there's five types of buses, A, B, C, and D, and then the type 3s. The A's are the ones that have, like, the van front on them, and then the B's are kind of a different-looking bus that look like a UPS truck or something. And then the C is, like, your conventional bus with a hood and, you know, like a 68 per or student capacity. And then the D's are the big pushers with the engine located behind the windshield. And then we go to the type 3s, which are basically your Suburban, Dodge Caravan, or even a car. So I don't feel they need an endorsement to operate those kinds of vehicles. If you have a driver's license, I think that that's adequate for these type of vehicles. The coaches aren't doing curbside pickup. You know, it's taking the students from school to an activity. So it's not like a bus that's using an eight-way system or something like that. And then they're concerned about expanding the license level from D, where we were, to including A, B, C, and D. That shouldn't be a concern because anybody with a B license, that's for any single unit. So we're talking about a 68,000-pound cement mixer. I mean, if you can operate that, you can drive, I believe, a Suburban, okay. And the A, of course, is combination of vehicles. Basically, we're talking semis and those kinds of things. So, and C is a single unit. That's not a commercial license. But so I don't think that that's an issue by opening it up to the different licenses. That shouldn't be a problem anywhere, I don't believe.
Any questions from the committee? Any comments?
With that, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate your support and that this would move on to the Judiciary Committee if it passes.
Senator Olsen moves Senate File 33, Type 3 school bus legislation, to be passed and forwarded to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senate File is adopted.
That's it.
This concludes the bills that we're going to hear for today. We have two reports, two special reports. One is from the Department of Vehicle Services. Ms. Pat McCormick.
Mr. Chair, if you will.
Commissioner Campion.
Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. I'm going to give a couple of very brief introductory remarks. And then Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, and Colonel Mark Donansky, the Chief of the State Patrol, will come up and give a very short overview of each one of those two divisions.
Thank you. Could we have some of the conversations move out of the room, please?
Of the departments within the divisions within the Department of Public Safety, four divisions are under the jurisdiction of this division. The two that I mentioned, and the Office of Traffic Safety and the Office of Pipeline Safety. The Office of Traffic Safety, its director is Cherie Marty. The mission of the Office of Traffic Safety is to lead efforts to prevent traffic deaths and serious injuries by changing human behavior. The umbrella campaign with which this goal is intended to achieve is the Toward Zero Death initiative. The Office of Traffic Safety is very mindful that fulfilling this mission will takes a concentrated and coordinated effort with a large number of traffic agents, stakeholders, and organizations, each working together. The Office of Traffic Safety receives about $435,000 in trunk highway funds. That money leverages approximately $27 million from the federal government for a various number of Office of Traffic Safety related projects, to include safe and sober enforcement grants, law enforcement and prosecutor training grants, highway safety and hazard elimination, nighttime concentrated alcohol patrol type activity. Most of the money, or the vast majority of the money that comes in to the Office of Traffic Safety from the federal government, goes out to local units of government for any number of these traffic related prevention and safety programs. As I mentioned here the other day in the primary seatbelt testimony, Mr. Chair and members, Minnesota has realized the lowest traffic fatality rate in Minnesota since 1944, World War II. It was a very significant achievement. It's not the Office of Traffic Safety alone's responsibility to achieve that, but certainly they in concert with an awful lot of traffic safety stakeholders in multi-disciplines throughout the entire state of Minnesota. The Office of Pipeline Safety, its mission is to protect lives and property and environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and education. The Office of Pipeline Safety was created in 1987 after a major pipeline release ignited in Moundsview, Minnesota, killing some people in that particular area. There are 17 people in the Office of Pipeline Safety. Elizabeth Zeldenwick is the chief engineer. Again, there is no general fund money trunk highway money that funds the Office of Pipeline Safety. Approximately $1 million comes from special revenue funds, and another $1 million+ comes from federal grant funds. The special revenue funds are derived from pipeline safety inspections, fees, and pipelines. One of the programs within the Office of Pipeline Safety is the Gopher State One Call, which I think most people are familiar with. This requires anyone doing any excavating or digging must call the Gopher One call to prevent any serious injuries or during the excavation tapping into some electrical or gas or other dangerous line. It certainly has saved a number of lives over the years, and it's been my understanding from the Office of Transportation, Federal Office of Transportation Pipeline Safety, really a model for the country. I think the best trivia question in the Department of Public Safety is how many gas and or pipelines zigzag through the state of Minnesota. I bet you Senator Murphy might know the answer to that question. How many miles of pipeline, liquid or gas, zigzag through the state of Minnesota? that falls under this jurisdiction of the Office of Pipeline Safety?
Senator Murphy, an answer, please.
It's in the thousands.
63,000 miles. Yeah. It's a pretty astonishing number, but that's a responsibility for that mm-hmm. Office of Pipeline Safety has. With that, that would conclude my comments, unless there's any questions, Mr. Chair.
Are there any comments or questions? Thank you, Commissioner Campion.
Thank you very much. I would ask that Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, come up, please, along with Colonel Danaski.
Ms. Director.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, and we tried to present you with a fact sheet to kind of give you background and up-to-date statistics regarding the division. As you've heard me say many times, the mission of Driver and Vehicle Services is to provide fair, accurate, secure, and timely service to our customers through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support to our staff as well as our business partners. Our annual budget is approximately $45 million, and we generate and collect about $1.1 billion of state revenues on an annual basis. We also receive some funding to administer our plate program, our vehicle plate program, from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. We have approximately 520 positions and in within our agency, and we have state offices located at 98 locations throughout the state. And that would include exam stations as well as our town square office. And we have two inspection sites at Como Avenue here in St. Paul and in Royalton. In terms of vehicle registration, in 2007, we issued over 1.5 million vehicle titles, and we processed about 4.3 million vehicle registrations. We also maintain 6.4 million vehicle records within our information system. We license and regulate auto dealers, and we have approximately close to 3,850 auto dealers in Minnesota. Our prorate office is responsible for the administration of two international registration and fuel tax agreements that affect motor carriers. And in Minnesota, we have 6,800 Minnesota-based trucking companies. In driver services, which is another one of our program areas, we are responsible for examining and evaluation of drivers and issuing driver's licenses and identification cards. In 2008, we issued over 1.6 million driver's license permits and cards, and we maintain a database of driving records of about 4.1 million records. We have 125 driver license agents that work with our exam staff, and we have 95 exam stations throughout the state. We also license commercial education school, driver education schools, and regulate 550 driver education instructors and approve 265 public school driver education programs, 25 accident prevention courses, 6 moped courses, and 28 DWI clinics. We evaluate approximately 100,000 drivers a year in terms of those that may have lost or are at risk of losing their driving privileges, either due to crashes, driving-related incidents, or to health problems. We also would conduct about 606,000 knowledge tests and administer driving exam tests as well, skill tests as well. In our support services program area, we are talking about services that we provide across our division, and that includes our public information center. We receive over 1 million telephone calls each year, and we also respond to about 72,000 emails on an annual basis. We also, at this Public Information Center, deal with our agents as well as law enforcement and driver's license agents. And we also have our special disability and plate unit. We issue over 63,000 special license plates and 91,000 disability parking permits, or excuse me, disability parking permits. As you all know, we are beginning on our project, and I talked about it at our last committee meeting, MNLARS project, the Minnesota driver and vehicle registration system, and we are on target in terms of the funding that we are collecting. We had estimated that based on the number of transactions we do a year, if we collected $1.75 on each transaction, we would collect about $1 million a month. That's approximately where we're at. A little over $6 million was collected by the beginning of January. And we are working on a high-level project plan that we will be able to provide the committee with, demonstrating our efforts to get this project done within the four-year period that you have authorized us to collect the revenue for. And so we are working on that. We are assigning some of our staff to the project and are filling in behind them with very skilled staff, and we believe we're on a good road in terms of trying to accomplish this this upgrade of our system so that we are really able to accomplish our mission of providing fair, accurate, secure, and timely services. And with that, I'm open for any questions you might have.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. McCormick, I have a very good suggestion, I think, that to your driver license examiners, you might want to add very soon hybrid car training. My daughter went to take her driver test in my hybrid car, and the license examiner had to tell her twice to start the car, and she said, "It is started, it is ready to go," and she made the comment, "Haven't you ever been in a hybrid car before?" She did fail the exam, and she thought it was because the guy had an attitude because she said that. So it would be nice if they had an idea how hybrids work.
Oops.
Well, Senator, Mr. Chair and Senator Jungbauer, I'll take that back to our exam staff. It's a good suggestion, something we definitely need to talk about.
Thank you.
Ms. McCormick, I'm advised that you have some new staff, and that some of them are probably in the audience with you. I'm wondering if maybe you would like to take a brief moment and just introduce them.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two members of our staff that are new to DVS. In one case, in her position, she's been with the department for a long time.
I need to say
35 years. Roxanne LeDucer is the Interim Vehicle Services Program Director. Larry Olala, who has been serving in that capacity, is now working on the MNLARS project. And so Roxanne came with us today, and you'll be seeing her at hearings throughout the session. And then we have a new Legislative and Rules Coordinator, Marna Johnson, and she's with us as well. And so she's a contact. If you're not able to reach us, I'll make sure that the staff have Marna's number as well. So. Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Donansky.
I think.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, Senator.
I got a really easy question.
Senator Day.
Mr. Chair, how many Minnesota driver's license do we have? How many people are there that have a Minnesota driver's license?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Day, it's around 3.6 million drivers.
Thank you.
Senator Stephen.
Mr. Chair and Ms. McCormick, I don't know if you know this. It's probably not quite in your purview, but I noticed that 6% of the state patrol's budget approximately is for gas, vehicle parts, supplies, and uniforms. And I remember that some of our local units of government have been able to lock in lower fuel prices now that they've seen the drop in fuel. And I was wondering if you know if the State Patrol does that or is able to do that too.
Senator Sieben, I would, Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, I defer to Colonel Donaski in case he knows that question. I don't know that.
Colonel Donaski.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Mark Donaski. I serve as Chief of the Minnesota State Patrol. Mr. Chair, Senator, the question was, did we lock into fuel pricing?
Right. If you're able to Senator Sieben, to do that, like some of our local units of government have able to do to see cost savings.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Colonel Donaski.
I won't say it's a complex issue. We did look last year into locking into pricing, and there are sometimes advantages to doing that. I know one local municipality, a large municipality, that locked in last year, and unfortunately they're currently now paying $3.40 a gallon for gas while we are experiencing the low side. There was a challenge, and there has been a challenge for us in that the state regulations prohibited us in some ways and forms to going into these types of contracts for fuel. We are currently exploring with them, with the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Administration, ways in which perhaps not locking into a bulk amount of fuel, but entering into a service with a vendor who may provide us some type of a discount at the pump price versus locking into a set price, if that answers your question, Senator.
Mm-hmm. It does. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Moy.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to comment on the earlier introductions of the staff. You know, the tale that you never know when you're going to see friends again, and I'm very glad to see Ms. Johnson in the audience. We practice law together, and it's really good to see her here at the legislature.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Ms. McCormick, recently there was appears to be an opinion that was written by our Attorney General that took away the administrative suspension from our court system on those offenses for monetary reasons. I'm not talking about those offenses that were committed in a moving vehicle. Those are still standing, but they're sending back all the paperwork now on the suspensions for non-payment. Say there's and it doesn't matter if they're a juvenile or an adult. I'll use a case of one that I know of for sure. Juvenile burns down his neighbor's garage or starts a fire in his neighbor's garage. several hundred dollars where the tools are destroyed and several hundred dollars to the inside of the building needed to be upgraded. The young man went to court. He said that he was going to part of the court order was for him to pay the family back. Well, when he became 16, he decided that he wasn't going to pay the family back, and so the court suspended his driver's license, and then the Attorney General sent the paperwork back. No, I'm sorry. The paperwork that was sent back that said you can't do this came from your office. Apparently, it was an AG's opinion. I was at a national conference when, and I was sitting there with a member from the NTSB, one from AAA, and Senator Dibble. And the person who was giving the overview stated clearly that the deputy registers, the leaders of all the division of vehicle services around the United States, in unison, she said, which I found hard to believe, decided that these administrative suspensions had to stop if they were not directly attributable to a moving violation. Now, in this case of the 16, 17, 18-year-old person that wants to get their driver's license, or even the person that's 51 and wants to keep his driver's license, yet I infringe on Senator Dibble's property and destroy something, and there's a judgment against me, I still think that we need to have the ability to suspend those administratively. Sometimes, for a couple different reasons. One, it's so much cheaper. Because what happens now is our court down in Goodhue County has to issue a summons. We all know that costs money. You know, you got to hand it off to a deputy. Deputy's got to go out to the person's house and serve it. Now, everybody down in Goodhue County knows that the deputy goes out on Friday afternoon. So if you think that you might be getting one of these knocks on the front door, you go fishing. Most of the time, the deputy has to go out 4, 5, 6 times to get some of these served. For a $100 fine, sometimes we're spending $200, $300, $400 to collect it. And if there's a way that you could check with the AG's office and find out why it is that we don't, what legally, because I've called and I haven't gotten a response, but that's not unusual sometimes. We need, our court system needs to have this ability to administratively suspend driver's license. I know that it creates more work for your agency, but it's just a stroke of a button, right? Is that about?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Murphy, I would say I'm not at all familiar with this issue, and I've never heard it discussed at any meeting I've been at a national level. I have never heard this discussion at all in my years with AMVA or with any other association. But in terms of what the costs would be to the division, the costs would probably amount to the fact, you know, it would be additional burdens in terms of people at the counters, people that have to come into the phone center. I mean, there would be costs associated with it. I wouldn't be able to estimate it without knowing what we're talking about, but there would certainly be costs to our staff and also in the number of records that we would be handling in addition, and driving records that may impact, and there may also be impact in terms of operations of the, I mean, in terms of vehicles, too, depending what the law says. So it's hard for me to respond unless I see language and understand more. I haven't heard about this particular incident either, so I'll see what I can find out and report back to the committee.
Okay, that'd be great. And, Mr. Chairman, if you'd allow me just another second here. Ms. McCormick, when we were listening to this presentation, I don't remember if Senator Dibble remembers this too much or not, but the woman did mention AMBA and a lot of different things, and I just thought, you know, she's not conversing with, you know, our Division of Vehicle Services, because I didn't think that was the, you know, the way that you guys wanted to do business. After several of us were done with the testifier that day, she decided she had to go right to the airport. She left right away. The NTSB was very unhappy with their testimony. So,
any other questions and comments? Senator Dibble.
You recall it was fun just sitting back and listening to the reaction to that panel from Senator Murphy and a few other legislators from around the country. That was worth the price of admission.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, now I think Colonel Donansky.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Once again, my name is Mark Donansky with the Minnesota State Patrol. Thank you for allowing us to come and give a very brief overview of a little bit about the State Patrol and what we're moving forward with. Just so that you know that, once again, the men and women wearing maroon are out doing your business. In the last 36 hours, of course, it's not a typical weather day, but in the last 36 hours, the Minnesota State Patrol has responded to nearly 900 crashes, 729 of them property damage, 117 rollovers. Of that number, again, 98 personal injury crashes, 28 of which are rollovers. We responded to over 700 vehicles just off the roadway. We assisted 250 motorists. We took 21 driving complaints. We assisted 56 separate agencies in the last day and a half. And, of course, it's not a typical weather day. But, again, just a snapshot of when the weather does go bad on us, that the patrol has to ramp up very quickly to respond to the incidents that are out there. In addition, last year when I was before this committee, we talked about the hazards there are to troopers out on the roadway. I think we even showed a video perhaps of a trooper that had been struck. We've been very fortunate this year that we haven't had anybody seriously injured. However, just to pass along, since December 1st of last year through today, which is about 45 days, we've had 17 of our cruisers struck alongside the roadway, five of which have been completely totaled. So it's an ongoing process when the weather comes and the patrol is out there doing their job to put themselves in harm's way. We did pass out, or I believe it was passed out, a information packet, a legislative fact sheet for you, and I think that it has a lot of the factoids and facts, numbers that are interesting. I'm not going to bother by going over a lot of them. They show some of the activities that we've had in the past. Of note, I think, is to mention that the State Patrol does have an annual operating budget of about $82 million, and I believe back on page 5 of that handout we have a breakdown of where the appropriations come for that funding, and then the approximate allocations that we use that funding for across our organization. As you can see, 78% of the funds go towards the salaries and benefits of our employees, and then smaller fractions thereof. To answer, carry on with the senator's question about fuel, we are very cognizant of how we spend the taxpayers' dollars, and in particular those areas such as gas prices where we see large fluctuations where they're down one time and up the next time. And we're always looking for new and different processes that we can lock in and keep those prices down. We are somewhat, I don't even say hampered, but of course this past year was the first year that we purchased a significant number of our Ford Cruisers that are E85 compliant. And the E85 compliance is in many ways very good for us. The fuel is cheaper, although when you get to greater Minnesota, it's more difficult for us to find E85. On the converse side, the mileage on it is significantly less, and so we have to have the cruiser stopping in for gas more often. But along the line, I just want to assure the committee that we are looking at these issues on a constant basis, and I will talk about that in just a moment. Second on the fact sheet that I think that I do want to draw your attention to is on the bottom of the first page. I spoke to you last year when I was here about our strategic plan. We continue to be guided by four overarching goals in our organization. Simply put, there were to reduce deaths and injuries on our highways, to maximize our service to the public and to provide assistance to our allied agencies, to effectively acquire and deploy resources while enhancing our efficiency, and to really retain and develop and maintain a quality, diverse workforce at the Minnesota State Patrol. And we'll say that as we go through changes and process, and I'm just going to mention a couple of the ones that we're moving forward with, those strategic goals really guide our decision-making. Along that line, just give you a note. In the past year, of course, the number one strategic goal for us is to reduce deaths and injuries. And I'm happy to report that has been reported before this committee a number of times that we will see a significant decrease in fatalities in the state of Minnesota. As Commissioner Campion pointed out last year, we're very proud of that. We would like to think that we played a role in that reduction as well. In the last year, what we've done is we really have put an emphasis on seatbelt enforcement. We've really gone out and talked to the troopers and to local agencies about taking the time. And I'm going to take that back, not even so much about seatbelt enforcement, but about seatbelt compliance. Because it isn't always about issuing a citation. Sometimes it's talking to people. Sometimes it's giving them a warning. Sometimes it's a citation. But at the end of the day, what we want people to do is wear their seatbelts. And however we get our law enforcement officers and our troopers to do that, that's the process we're going through. And we have seen an increased activity, and I do believe that the corresponding increase in seatbelt compliance in our state is partially because law enforcement has stepped up to the plate and taken it on as a priority. And I believe in my heart that because of that increase, we clearly have people alive today that wouldn't be if we didn't take that task on. In addition, the last year, and I think I spoke about it last year as well, we've really moved to more a data-driven enforcement plan in the state of Minnesota. Even so much as where we're deploying or where we're assigning troopers in the state permanently to the shifts that they work, to the days that they worked, and where they work, and what violations they're looking for. We're using data to find out where people are becoming involved in crashes, what's causing those crashes, and what time they're being caused, and we're directing our activities in those areas. One of the real exciting programs, and you heard about it last year, of course, was the HEAT program, which is a heightened enforcement process, and we hope to work with our partners over at the Office of Traffic Safety to put that program out again. But we had entered into a venture with the Department of Transportation in Mankato, which I think is really interesting. As you're aware, we gather a bunch of data from MnDOT using the loops that are embedded in the highways. The Department of Transportation really only has a finite number of those loops out there, and once we go out into those particular areas, frankly, it's not unlike fishing. You go out and you fish the hole long enough, eventually you don't catch any more fish there. People get the idea, which is a good thing. But now it comes, where do we direct our resources again? And so we've worked very diligently with MnDOT, and actually through a joint venture with the Iowa State Patrol, they have what are called traffic analyzers, high-tech stuff. It's a little stainless steel plate that's about 12 inches long and about 8 inches wide. And what the Department of Transportation is allowed to do is go out and put it on a piece of highway, and it literally is a small computer, and it gathers data over a period of 48 or 72 hours or 4 or 5 days for us. And then we can go and we can pick the recorder up, and we plug it into a computer, and it tells us how many vehicles went over that spot. It tells us how fast they were going. It tells us what day it was, what hour it was. As a matter of fact, it'll even tell us the time and the temperature of that particular location. In that way, when we receive complaints from local jurisdictions or we have ideas that there's issues going on out there, we can gather that data so that we can adequately put resources out into those specific areas. Again, that's just one example. We're partnering with our Department of Transportation to really put our focus where we're out there. The other thing on the traffic side that I think is really important and really pertinent, and under the direction of Commissioner Campion, I think is moving forward very well, is the idea that on the state trunk highways, our jurisdictional highways, really only account for about half the fatalities and half of the serious injury crashes. That means in the communities and the county roads and on the local highways, there are still a lot of people that are dying and being injured. And as a statewide traffic agency, it's easy for us to say that's not our problem, but that is our problem. And so we've taken it upon ourselves to work closely with our other local law enforcement agencies, the sheriff's departments, the local police departments, to work with them to use our expertise in traffic enforcement and meld into the programs that they have. As a matter of fact, we have an initiative coming up. There's another data-driven program that talks about when crimes are happening in communities and trying to find out if there's some correspondence between when the crimes are happening, when the crashes and the issues are happening to impact the state patrol. And that way, we can focus the attention of not only the state patrol, but local jurisdictions. At times, it will impact traffic safety both on our jurisdictional highways as well as the local highways, and even potentially have an impact on crime in those communities. We work very closely with the sheriff's office, as I said. Some of the other programs that we run are our Safe and Sober program, NICAP, Click It or Ticket, and a myriad of other programs that we're working hand-in-hand with local officers. And I think I'm very happy to say that the local jurisdictions are tending to embrace more and more traffic safety as really being a part of community safety. Along the lines of, and I will be brief, as I mentioned, one of the other things we are trying to do, and once again, we do recognize that it is a very difficult period of time economically for the state and for a lot of people. We are looking at the efficiencies in our organization, and as I mentioned before, one of the strategies that we have is to look for those alternatives so that we can operate more efficiently with whatever resources we have. To that end, some of the things that we started in the past year before even the budget crisis really presented itself was that by the end of this month and by the middle of next month, I will be proposing a document to the Commissioner of Public Safety that will look at the answering points, our emergency answering points, in other words, our dispatch centers. We have a program going. We're under contract with a contractor to do a study to give us an idea if we can consolidate our 911 centers. We currently have 11 centers, and by the middle of next month, I will give the Commissioner of Public Safety a proposal to reduce those numbers to something smaller across the state. We're working together with the Department of Transportation in the metropolitan area. As you're probably aware, we have an East Metro District and a West Metro District for the State Patrol. We're working with MnDOT down here and potentially coming together if we can find a facility with MnDOT to put them together to eliminate two districts and make them in one district and hopefully use some of the synergy of that to be more efficient in the metropolitan area. Our training academy, which is currently located at Arden Hills at the MnDOT facility up there, is in the process of a three-year transition of moving from Arden Hills to Camp Ripley, where we hold our academy. We'll move all of our training to Camp Ripley as well. By holding our training at Camp Ripley, we have the ability to put our personnel up in barracks, which saves us the cost of putting people in hotels down here when they're going to training. In addition, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Natural Resources, the National Guard all have training facilities and ongoing training programs that are going on up there. We're working hand-in-hand with those organizations so that we can share the resources that are putting forth up at Camp Ripley. Additionally, and it sounds like it may be very small, but a couple of things. We work very closely with the Department of Administration as they rolled out their new fleet management program, M5. We embraced it. I don't want to speak critically of some other organizations, but it was complicated and it had a lot of challenges, and going back over years and decades of information and loading it into a program so that we could better understand our fleet management. We embraced it, we've gone on it, and I can report to this committee that although it was ugly in the start and we had to catch up on a lot of maintenance items that I guess we didn't even realize we were behind, I think that we're starting to see the fruits of that effort in that we're not having engines blowing up at 60,000 miles and transmissions aren't going out. It may seem trivial, but $4,000 or $5,000 for a transmission or $4,000 for an engine means a big deal, and if all it takes is making sure that you change oil on time and holding people accountable for it, that's what we're doing. And then lastly, and again, it doesn't rise to the level of the size of our budget, but we are in the process of dispersing two of the State Patrol's aircraft that we are going to, we feel we can consolidate our fleet operations, still provide the service that we do for our traffic enforcement program and for all our allied agencies across the state, but we can do so with two less aircraft, and we're in the process of selling those aircraft. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I would, on behalf of the Minnesota State Patrol, I would truly like to thank this committee for your continued support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Colonel Danaski, I have a question that is really rather small, but I think you have a captive audience or a captive group here with the E85 automobiles that you said that you were purchasing. What has been the experience? Has it been good? Has it been bad? Any thoughts on that? And are you monitoring the efficiencies that you get from them?
Mr. Chair, members, we just purchased the E85 Fords this year. Unfortunately, we were running Chevrolets last year, and Chevrolet decided not to make maroon cruisers or make maroon police cars last year. It wasn't a fleet color for them. And so the offset of what the Chevrolets cost us, that they were less than the Fords, to have them repainted actually pushed them higher than the cost of the Fords. So we ended up buying the E85 Fords this year. The gas mileage is about 4 miles per gallon less, 3 to 4 miles per gallon less than standard fuel, but the price is less. And so in some cases, it depends on what the price of the fuel is. It's almost an even offset. In some cases, it's plus. In some cases, it's minus. The biggest complaint that I get from the troopers is that they have to fill the cars up more often. But all in all, I don't think that it's been a bad process.
Thank you. Senator Saltzman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Colonel Danaski, you know, I want to thank the State Patrol because this last summer you were very helpful with the Stillwater Police in the heavy trucks that were not safe that were going across the Stillwater Bridge. And this is not the bridge that or the truck that shut the bridge down, but it's really something that I know that community is struggling with because what I think was found is that the trucks that are going across the bridge are causing the traffic congestion and trying to make these left-hand turns with very large freight trucks are really using that route to get around going through the weigh station on 94. If you at any point, and you may not have an answer today, but if at any point you have any suggestions for us, I do remember that when you were there, I believe one of the trucks not only did not meet the exam, but also hit one of your brand new cars. So it was probably a very bad day for that driver. And made the front page of the Stillwater Gazette. That's the big news in Stillwater. So if you have any other suggestions, because it's an issue for that community about the bridge and having a new bridge, but it really is also about the safety and what's happening downtown and the fact that these trucks, once they cross the bridge, are going on our roads. And it is an interstate commerce issue to some degree and working with the Wisconsin Patrol as well. But anything that we can do to address that, whether it be through policy or legislation or programs, it really is very disturbing to that, to my community.
Mr.
Colonel
Chair,
Danaski.
Senator, thank you for the question. Commercial vehicles have clearly risen, along with school bus, are two of the hot topics that are out in traffic safety right now. And it's because they are very high profile. And although we look at the traffic fatalities that are caused around commercial vehicles, and I think everybody here probably recognizes it's not the commercial vehicles that are causing the majority of the crashes, it's the activity of the cars that are in and around the commercial vehicles, I think we do recognize that, especially in these economic times, that violations of weight and some of the other issues that are going on are detrimental to the economy through our infrastructure damage. To that end, we have a lot of laws. And once again, thanks to this committee and to the legislature, the Minnesota State Patrol, I think, has a very good a basket of resources to put out there. Part of the challenge, and I think we're trying to get across that, Senator, is this. Commercial vehicles and commercial vehicle enforcement is exceptionally complicated. And what you have is you have even state troopers who go through a significant amount of training after they've been on for a couple of years and look at a commercial vehicle and go, I don't know if I really know what I'm supposed to be looking for when I stop that vehicle, let alone a local police officer or a sheriff's deputy. And so what we're doing is we have 71 commercial vehicle inspectors that work for us, civilian inspectors. They're always available to local jurisdictions. If somebody wants to call them to come and do an inspection, they will bring all that expertise and knowledge along with them. But more importantly, Captain Urquhart, who is here before you today, has a very strong outreach program to the local jurisdictions talking about truck enforcement. And what we're trying to do is to at least get local jurisdictions to stop the vehicles and give them the three or four or five things that they should be looking for at that stop. And if they find some problems in those three or four questions that they ask the driver, then certainly feel free to give the Minnesota State Patrol a call. We'll send an expert out there that can help walk through that. So in response to your question, Senator, I don't know that, from my point, I don't know that there really needs to be, I'm not thinking of specific legislation now. It really is incumbent upon us to work more closely with local organizations and even my organization and convince people that the commercial vehicle program is something we need to pay attention to.
Thank you.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Senator Saltzman, my idea would be just to take the Stillwater Bridge out and put a new one up. And
Senator Murphy, I appreciate that attitude, and so does my community.
Senator Saltzman.
So thank you.
And Mr. Chairman and,
Senator
and members, and I was serious, I think that bridge should be taken out, and regardless whether people want to make it a footpath or not, it's inappropriate where it's at. And one of these days, wisdom will prevail on the Stillwater Bridge. But, Colonel, first I want to just let the committee know that the Colonel is the first Minnesota police officer that's been appointed as the chair of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. And this is an international association. It's got tens of thousands of members worldwide, and so congratulations, Colonel. Good job, and somebody recognizes your expertise.
Mr. Chair,
Senator, Colonel Danesky.
I wish I could accept the presidency of that particular body. What I am is I've been my peers elected me from the 49 state police agencies, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and the provinces of Canada to the general chair of the state and provincial division of the International Association. However, I do happily serve on the Board of Officers of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Thank
but
you.
That, but that's the first time someone from Minnesota has held that spot? Is that?
Mr. Chair? Senator, that
Colonel
is correct.
Colonel Danesky.
Okay. Well, I might have embellished a little bit on the job.
Imagine.
But congratulations are in order anyway. And I really believe that Minnesota is well served with just all kinds of people in public service like yourself, Colonel, and Ms. McCormick as well, who just work diligently hours on end for the betterment of the folks in this room and our constituents. And we sure do appreciate it. You two folks are jewels in state government, and we really appreciate it. So, and the commissioner as well. Last question, Colonel, and this is in regards to the seatbelt law. Do you think that if we waived the fine and made them watch your videotape, that would be appropriate? The fine is small anyway. I think the tape is pretty powerful.
Colonel Danesky.
Mr. Chair, Senator, and I think this committee, I know that your comment may or may not be taken with some likeness to it. I don't think so. I mean, and honestly, I don't think so. I think that we've talked about in this body and other places that we've come up against this last 13%. And the 13% that don't want to buckle up, I don't know that a video like that is really going to make any difference for them. We have some people, we have some youth that if you saw in the video talking about it's not me, it's not going to happen, that will impact them. We may pick up a percent or two. But ultimately, that last 10%, they need a little push. They need something that's going to convince them. And unfortunately, again, our process is really about getting them to comply, not about punishment. It really is about getting compliance out of them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the only way that people will comply is if the state says, this is something you must do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and Colonel, and you can carry this back to the lieutenant and all the folks that worked on that video, that's a pretty powerful message. And the more schools you can get that in, the better. And if there's anything that any of us can do to help facilitate any of that, we stand ready. That's
Thanks,
a good video.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have Mua, Olsen, and Dibble. So, Senator Mua.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, was really moved by that video, and I thought that one of the things that would be really interesting is, I have a little 8-year-old boy who's a Cub Scout. And I think that the earlier, not necessarily that I want to show that video to my 8-year-old, mm-hmm. but I think the message here is that the more you can get boys at a younger age, I think exposure to the idea of seatbelts. I mean, whether we succeed in our primary seatbelt law or not, I think that there is, we must seek out every opportunity that we can, and I think those type of organized organizations, whether that's the Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, may be a good opportunity for us to see if we can. I was talking to the commissioner the other day that I might explore the option of trying to see if we can create a scouting badge around the, you know, seatbelt law in this in the state, because, and I'm sure, you know, your guys would be more than happy to come in and teach that course, and if they make it through, they get a badge or a patch, and I think that would be really, it would be really neat. So I'm going to do that. That being said, I'm interested in hearing a little bit more from you. I know that I can't recall if it was last year or the year before, we had talked a little bit about, I think you brought in your human resource person, and we talked a little bit about the personnel and the staffing and the age gap and looking at recruitment and developing a strategy around that transition because of the retirements. And I'm wondering if you could update us a little bit on where you're at.
Senator Mott, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Colonel Donaski.
Senator, thank you for the question. The Boy Scout concept is an outstanding idea. If I could just step back for that just a second as well, and believe me, I'd be more than willing to help with that. So if you want to contact me, we can certainly move forward. We did sit down with that video at great length and talk to people about it, what age would be appropriate to show it. And as a matter of fact, we took it to the Commissioner of Education and showed it to the Commissioner first before we even started going to the schools. And I don't know how much the Commissioner pointed out. Prior to going to the schools, we like the troopers to go in and sit down with the superintendent and the principal so that the administration of the school is clearly aware of what we're bringing into them, and because we don't want to offend anybody. We really want this to be an educational process. And it, you know, as part of that, we don't want to offend people because then we're going to push ourselves in the other direction. So combining those two things, I just going back to the seatbelt thing, the job of the Minnesota State Patrol is to get compliance. And as much as personally I would like to see a primary seatbelt, whether or not you get a primary seatbelt doesn't really matter to me. We're going to continue forward to do whatever we have to do to get people to buckle up. And your idea, as well as the video, I think, are going along that way. To the human resources process, I think that, as I mentioned before, one of our overarching goals is the recruitment of a diverse, well-qualified workforce. And I think that we've made great ends to that. I would tell this group, as I probably mentioned before, the Minnesota State Patrol in regarding diversity is woefully underrepresented. And we recognize that for a long time. And 3 years ago, we set on a path to try and adjust that and change that. I think that we've had great success in that area. However, when you're looking at law enforcement, changing a culture and changing personnel and process is something that you can't do in a biennium. It's not going to change in 2 years. It's probably not going to change in 4 years. But you set the course for that change. I'm happy to say that we took applicants this last year. We probably had the broadest pool of applicants that you would see. As a matter of fact, Senator, if I might point out, this year we ran a program that's never been run in the state of Minnesota before, where we opened up our application to anybody that held a 2-year college degree, regardless of whether you had a law enforcement or not. And then what we did was we went through that application pool just as though they were troopers. We didn't know whether they were the standard track of being in a law enforcement field or if they're a biologist. We did the background similar, did everything similarly. And we brought that group in. We had a selection process, and we actually selected 34 of those individuals, and we sent them to a community college to complete their law enforcement program. Upon the completion of that, they joined up with the individuals from a traditional track in the state and joined at our academy, and now they're in the process of becoming troopers simultaneously. In doing so, what we did was we looked at that broad pool of individuals that are in the law enforcement field and realized that frankly, there just wasn't enough diversity there. And so we opened up that field to a larger pool so we could potentially draw from that. We don't know until the academy's done, until these individuals have had some time on the road, whether or not it's going to be successful, whether or not the process is there. But I think it's an idea that's there that we can try, that we can move forward with it. In that way, we had nearly 1,000 applicants. And I will probably tell you that of the people that I saw coming through the door, the people that I've talked to, probably some of the finest, brightest young people that I've seen come into our organization. dovetailing with that just a little bit, not only is, now we always talk about troopers when we come. You have to understand that the Minnesota State Patrol also has about 300 civilian employees. Some of the individuals that you see guarding the Capitol Complex here, the guards we have, our commercial vehicle inspectors, our support staff, and other areas. And we're working very diligently in those areas as well to try and attract diversity. Our commercial vehicle inspectors, we're seeing great success in that area. And a new program that we started last year, 2 years ago, that's moving through now, going to you directly to your point about how we're reaching down into our recruiting, into the high schools and even to the elementary schools, is we have community service officers now. We actually have just one now, and we have 5 student workers. And these are individuals from diverse communities who are currently either in high school or in college that work part-time for us. But get a touch and a feel of what law enforcement is like, particularly the Minnesota State Patrol. It gives us an opportunity to see them and kind of help them through the process so when they get to that age and that time, they're ready to move into our academy and become a part of our organization.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, I have 2 quick questions for you. Those 17 vehicles that hit squad cars, are those people, are they charged? I mean, we should maybe, because obviously if they were going slower, if they were in control of their car, they wouldn't have hit these squad cars.
Colonel Danaski.
Senator, in most cases, they are charged. Frankly, in my case, again, coming back to the economics of it, my major concern is that we get their insurance card right away. And unfortunately, I know, in fact, the last 2 cars that we had totaled, both were blasted from the rear. Neither one of the drivers had insurance. And so we end up just taking that on the chin. Well, I shouldn't say taking it on the chin. We actually have a pretty aggressive program to go into conciliation court for it. But by the time we get through the whole process and we go to conciliation court, and the individual, if he doesn't have insurance, he or she doesn't have insurance, they probably don't have the assets for conciliation court to award us a thing anyway. So we as taxpayers end up taking that because we still have individuals out there who are driving without car insurance.
The second question I have is...
Senator Olsen.
You know, we've heard so much about the cable barriers, and I think in my traveling around the metro area and up to St. Paul a lot, I'm seeing people, bumpers are laying all over the place because they saved their head-on collision. However, do your troopers or the towing companies, whenever they pull somebody off of these, are they recording that so that somebody can be billed for the repairs? Because I think we need to look at that as our committee, because I'm seeing hundreds of these where they've been hit and they're not being repaired. So I think we have to look at this stuff.
Mr. Chair.
Colonel Danaski.
Senator, is an outstanding question. I will tell you that I think that the Senator brought up a Towards Zero Death initiative in the state that we have, where we have the Minnesota State Patrol, the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Transportation, and many entities working closely together. One, I think, of the unheralded changes that took place over the last several years are those cable barriers. I will tell you that my organization, not necessarily me, but my organization was not particularly in favor of cable barriers because they restrict us from our speed enforcement. We can't get from one side of the highway to the other side of the highway to chase somebody down. And fire departments were leery of them because it eliminated places where they can cross over, where you can go over. Having said that, over the last 2 years, I have no doubt in my mind that there are many, many lives that we have today because of those cable barriers that are out there. On a day like today, if you'd go up and down the highways, you would see, unfortunately, the remnants of what somebody attempting to cross over or getting caught in it is. Also, having said that, though, there is a lot of damage out there. Prior just to coming in here, I had a trooper call in a report to MnDOT that the entire stretch of a barrier was down, and it's literally, you know, we're talking a half a mile between crossovers. It's gone. It's just completely been hit so many times in the last 2 days that there's no cable left. So it is going to cost somebody a lot of money. We do tag all damaged property. It doesn't matter whether you hit a bridge, guardrail, if you damage even a delineator post. If you hit a post that has a mile marker number on it and you take it off, we put a marker on it that says, this is the driver that hit this post. We need to get to them to pay for it. With all due respect, we go back to the same thing with the squad cars. We have a significant number of people in the state that don't have an insurance, and so we end up swallowing those.
Senator Goldstein, I think I can give you a little bit of help on that one. My son took out a sign, and he was billed for it. So we did pay for that. From then on, we did call that David's sign because it does have a repair on it. And we paid for that.
Mr. Chair, my concern
Senator Olsen.
When a section, maybe a 30-foot section, is wiped out, it's usually the braces that hold the cable in place that drops. The cable is still there, but it's sagging. And so if somebody else were to go into that area, there's a good chance they could go over the cable. So I think we have to... This isn't a state patrol issue, this is a MnDOT issue, that we have to look at getting on those and getting the as soon as possible. But I appreciate that you guys are taking that information down so that we can only their own little section.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olstein, in that regard, as soon as MnDOT is able to, they get out and they fix the guardrails as soon as possible, put back up the cable medium barriers, and if you've got a specific section, just give the commissioner a call, and they'll get it as soon as they can. I mean, you know, you wouldn't expect them to be out today. It'd be very difficult to get 8 hours work today knowing that, I mean, you can only work outside for 10 minutes and then warm for 15. And
okay. Senator Dribble, and we need to move along as quickly as possible.
All right. Thanks. I once had to keep an eye on a city tree that my niece hit with my car. They told me if it died, I was responsible for it. So for several years, I watered that tree. So it's doing very well. I just wanted to say to my colleagues, if you've got any trouble at all, if your constituents call in and they've got any trouble with a title issue or a license, driver's license issue or a tab issue or a license plate, anything that has to do with driver services or vehicle services, just give Pat McCormick a call. I think I get some question or inquiry or some vexing, naughty problem into my office once or twice a month, and every single time Pat or her people have managed to clear it up very, very quickly, and it makes you look really good and makes your office look really good. So I want to publicly thank Pat McCormick for the many, many constituent service matters that she's handled on my behalf, and probably come back here in a couple years because of that fine constituent service that we were able to deliver with her help. So thank you for that. And if you haven't turned to Pat for help, I encourage you to do so.
Senator Blanoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, thank you, Ms. McCormick, for your help. And just a quick question for the Colonel. Do you have a position or opinion on the use of Photocop in your work?
Commissioner, do I have a position or opinion?
Bold and ask.
I think that, Mr. Chair, and I think that I can take a large kind of macro view of this. I think that we would be remiss if we didn't, as I mentioned before, technology is out there for us to put a plate out on a highway to look at how fast people are going. I think that we would be remiss if we didn't look at new technologies and how we do everything out there. And so I think examining it and looking at new technologies is wonderful. I have, as a member of the state, I have concerns over process. I have concerns over process. I think that in some ways, I think that the technology is there. That a lot of these things can do not only in Photocop but also in speed enforcement. Some of the states, Arizona has a speed enforcement program. As a matter of fact, Senator Murphy and I have talked about it. And I think that we need to do due diligence and look at those and see if they can fit. But I think it isn't as easy as saying, will this be a great traffic enforcement program? I think that it has to be seen in the light of how is this going to affect our community? Are we really going to have members of our community to feel that they're being treated well through the due process of adjudication? Or are they really going to perceive this as being just another way that the state is or the city is going to be garnishing funds to fill some hole out there? And I think we have to find some middle ground in there between the technology that can do something and really what the outcome is with trying to keep a safe community, a community that has confidence in its law enforcement and its public officials.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Colonel Donaski, I have a question also. It's real quick and short. We talked about damage to the cable barriers, things like that. What's the best thing for a citizen to do when they would like to report a problem? Not a 911, but a damage or a, in fact, and I have a particular interest here. The lights on 35E from the walk path near 7th Street up to about Victoria are almost always out, and I'm not sure who to call, and I don't think of it until I'm driving there at night.
Mr. Chair.
So things like that, potholes, things like that, those are not really your purview, but it is would be handy if there was some place where citizens can call.
And Mr. Chair, I would be greatly surprised. I know that we do it on our website. I would be greatly surprised if MnDOT's website doesn't have some place where you could actually report that online. As a matter of fact, I think with the technology that's out there now, we're all trying to get people to send us email messages so we could return calls basically at our staff's convenience rather than trying to have somebody sitting and answering the telephone all the time and then having to direct it off to somebody. I would be very surprised. I can certainly find out for you, Senator, but
thank you.
Again, we do that on our website. People have the ability to come to our website and ask questions of us all the time.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chairman, Colonel, I'm just curious as to the rate of turnover for your troopers as retirements are coming in and the number of trainees going through your training academy as on an annual basis.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you again for the question. It depends. We've had, in the past couple of years, simply because of how people were brought into the organization, we had a little larger number of retirements. We anticipate now through the next 5 years that on average we'll probably see between 20 and 25 retirees annually. And depending, and once again, if the economy stays the way it is, some of these individuals may choose to stay longer. Our academies are run based on our ability to fund them and based on the ability to have vacancies. And so we look on an annual basis. We project out if we feel, if we look at the numbers to determine other cost factors, going back to the fuel. As you look at this chart in here, we basically have people and cars. And if the CAS, as you look on here, we drove 15 million miles. We burned about a million gallons of gas last year. If the price of gas is $2 a gallon, it's $2 million a year. If it goes to $3 a gallon, it's $3 million a year. If it's $4, it's $4 million a year. I still have the same budget, but I have $2 million less because I got to put it into gas tanks. That dictates the size of the academy they run. So what you'll find is you'll find a fluctuation in the number of troopers in our complement because we have to make up the shortages by basically holding those free. Currently, and once again, thanks to this committee and to the legislature and the governor, we were able to put on an academy. We currently have academy running right now that started on Sunday of 75 cadets that are coming through, and we hope to have them out on the highways and byways of the state this summer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dibble, do you have another comment?
Oh, I was going to tell you that we can call Scott McBride, who's our Metro District Operations Engineer. I don't know if he takes calls from the public, but at least our offices can call him. He takes care of stuff pretty quickly for us.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, we did have further coverage from on the Department of Vehicle Services from Ms. McCormick. Did you have more to say beyond what you've given us?
Mr. Chair, nothing more unless any members have any further questions.
Any questions? Well, with that, we have no more questions, and the meeting is adjourned.
If that works.